Okay, we're now entering in our afternoon session. I hope lunch was good for everyone. Al just reminded me that we are recording all these speeches or presentations, and CDs will be available after the convention. They have to be paid for and signed up for prior to leaving today, if you're interested. Our next speaker is going to be Stan Rydell, long-term member of Calix. Good member, very active member. He's done a lot for this convention. I'd like for him to talk.
Thank you. Doesn't Chuck look a lot more comfortable now? Well, I had a good lunch. I hope you did. My name is Stan, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm also a member of Al-Anon and a very grateful member of Calix, Unit Number 2 in St. Paul. We thank you for the time that you took to come here and visit with us, especially those who have traveled some distance to get here. We know it's a sacrifice, and we appreciate it as members of Calix. I've been asked to speak today on both AA and Al-Anon, so I'm going to be using my notes to make sure I cover as much as I can in the time allotted to me, or else I ramble. I was raised, much like Father Dave was, in an alcoholic family, but really didn't realize the effect this had on me until I began to drink myself. Much to my disappointment. The primary alcoholicism in my family was my mother, and I began to see this changing personality when I was about 10 or 11 years old. And about that time, we moved to a new home in Falcon Heights, just outside of the city, in a small village at that time. And I started a new school, and I was in a fifth grade. My mother was a periodic, and I didn't know what was really going on or what it was going to be like when I got home from school. But I assumed that for some reason it was my fault. I must have done something wrong. And I was the middle of three boys. And I was usually the one to stay home and nurse her back to health the morning after a long night. And one of the things that used to really bother me when I had to take time to more or less replay, what happened the night before. It was like 20 questions. What did I, what happened then? What happened? And it used to irritate me, why does she keep bringing this up? And little did I know that a few years before myself, I started to drink, and I had no idea what a blackout was. And I just couldn't understand why she couldn't remember. I told myself I'd never drink. I swore that to myself. And put my family through that situation that we all lived in. My mother, she actually drank until she was about 83 or 84, periodically, and she, in I think it was 2099, she had a heart attack in her home. This was after my dad had passed away, and my daughter actually found her on the floor. She'd been there for 5 days, and she had had a heart attack and was in pretty bad shape. Well, she actually survived that. She was almost completely dehydrated, and much to her chagrin, that was the last time she ever was in her house. From there, she was in a health care situation for about 89 days until we found her an assisted care place. And she lived there for 3 years before she had her second and fatal heart attack. But during that time, I think she kind of resented it at first that she had to move from her home. And I did feel sorry for her, but at the same time, I was kind of, you know, you got a good guy and a bad guy. And I was the guy that had to tell her to, she couldn't drive anymore and take away her car and stuff like that. So she was kind of irritated with me for the first few months. And I resented that. I resented the fact that I would go out there and try to help her and do her med box and stuff like that, and I really resented it. And I remember I talked to a good friend of mine who happens to be in the program. He's in the Al-Anon program, and he was my retreat master 1 year out at Demontreville. And I told him I wanted to talk about something, and he, you know, we talked about my mother, and he says, come on back in the afternoon. He said, I'd like to talk to you again. And we talked for about three times. And the third time we're talking, he says, Stan, he said, what do you expect from your mother? And I said, well, you know, I said, I'd just like her to look me in the eye and just say, you know, I'm sorry for everything. And he started to laugh. I says, what's so funny? He said, well, you know, and I know that that's not going to happen. He says, she's not going to do that. She's not ready for that. She won't accept her problem, he said, and she's not going to do that. So he gave me a prayer of resentment, to forgive resentment. And he said, say this for a year. And I tell you, I can't believe how that changed my attitude. I don't know how it affected my mother, but it changed my attitude toward her. And long, long ago, I gave up blaming her for anything, especially my drinking. I always accepted my alcoholism as my problem, not her problem. But from time to time, resentment would rear its ugly head. And until I really went through that prayer situation with for a year, that it really worked. Worked so well, I gave the prayer to my brother. So I hope it worked for him too. And I guess when I first started drinking, like I said, it was a disappointment to me. I was really unhappy with myself. But at the same time, I found a friend. I mean, the first thing I said to myself was, what have I been afraid of? You know, why have I been afraid to drink? I mean, you know. And I have to say, for the first few years, there wasn't many problems as far as that goes. I wasn't drinking that frequently, and I didn't get any problems right away. And so I thought, well, this can't be too bad. But I was still unhappy with myself. It wasn't until I really got into my senior year where I had a couple of, I didn't start drinking until it was like my junior year, after my junior year of high school, towards the end of completing my junior year. And so it was kind of brief time, but during my senior year in high school, I ran into some problems. And at that time, I had a couple of friends of mine, good friends, that would say, you know, Stan, you shouldn't drink. You're a different person when you drink. And I'd say, you know, John, you should mind your own business. I was no way going to listen to that. I didn't want to listen to it because it was a healing thing for me. I could forget everything that was on my mind. I only drank for about 7.5 years. But during that 7.5 years, I spent 2 years in the Army. I went to school for a semester. I worked for 5 years in a factory. I married a wonderful girl, had two beautiful daughters, smashed up two cars, was in jail twice, and made myself completely miserable. I was totally unhappy with the way I was living. I was totally unhappy with that face in the mirror when I'd wake up in the morning. And it just bothered me. And, you know, and I'd hear more and more from people that would suggest to me that maybe you have a problem with alcohol. And I didn't want to hear that. I was great at apologizing. I would come home and tell Sue, you know, I'm sorry. You know, this is never going to happen again. And I meant it. And I might even enjoy a couple of weeks of not drinking, you know, none at all. And, you know, those periods of time would almost build her spirits up, you know, and say, well, maybe he means it this time. And then, boom, I'd start drinking again. The last year and a half that I drank was probably the worst. It's when I had all my problems with cars and poles and the police. And it was financially rough. But even during that period, I didn't quit drinking. And I made a lot of promises. There were a lot of, you know, I'm sure she cried herself to sleep a lot. I was the type of guy that might get paid on a Friday night, and, you know, I didn't come home till Sunday. And, you know, that's not very responsible for a guy with two kids. And I was spending money that I didn't have. And I really, you know, I didn't like it. I didn't feel good about it, but I didn't know what to do about it. And those short periods of sobriety, those dry periods, I didn't even enjoy them. It was a pity. I mean, I wasn't drinking, but God, it was terrible. So I didn't get anything out of those at all. On a Friday night in February of 1965, I had gotten paid, and I said, well, I was halfway down university on the way home. And I said, you know, I'm going to go back there. I'm going to cash my check. I'm going to have one beer and show her that I can do this. Well, it didn't work. I ended up home early Sunday morning. And the door was locked. There was about two or three boxes with stuff that I considered, you know, personal belongings. And a little sign in the door that said, Stan, we don't need you anymore. Well, what are you talking about, you know? I'm still half stiff, and I was angry. I go, what does she mean by that? So I walked around to the back door, kicked in the back door in the kitchen, and passed out on the kitchen floor. Of course, the next morning I woke up and I was shaking, and I needed a drink real bad that morning. And the door was locked between the living room and the kitchen, and I was pleading with her, you know, would you just, you know, you're going to get out of here, get out of here. I said, I'll get out. I said, just let me get out of here and take a bath, and I'll leave. Well, I did that, and she went next door. And when I came out of the bathroom, there was two of St. Paul's finest greeting me on Sunday morning and said, get dressed and get out of here. And if we get one more call back, you're going to jail. Well, I don't know if anybody has been to jail, but it's not very fun. And I didn't want to go to jail. So I said, I'll do it. I'll do it. And I was going to. It must have been a half hour, 45 minutes later. And there was a knock on the door. And I thought, oh, they're back. You know, I thought they came back to make sure that I was gone. And I opened the door, and there are two guys standing there. One of them was Charlie Van Avery. and another guy by the name of John O'Neill. I knew Charlie just by who he was. I knew his daughter through my sister-in-law. Didn't know John. I had no idea why they were there. And I remember I asked, I said, "What can I do for you?" And Charlie said, "Well, it's not what you can do for us, it's what I can do for you." He said, "I understand you got a drinking problem." Did you ever have anybody ask you that? The morning after about a 2.5 day run? Nah. And I looked at him and I says, "Well, I may drink a little bit, but, you know, I don't know if I have a problem." He says, "Can we come in and talk to you?" Well, I didn't know this, but he had called. My sister-in-law had actually called his daughter and told her about me and asked if he would come over and talk to me. He was a longtime member in AA. And he said, "Well," he said, "do you think he'll let me in?" And she said, "Oh, yeah." She says, "He's a friendly guy." I said, "I think he'll let you in." And I did. I let him in. And one of the things that amazed me is, for one guy I didn't know, one guy slightly, I just kept listening to them talk, and I'm wondering, why are these two guys sitting here telling me about their personal life like this, you know, what they did, you know, why? I couldn't understand why what they were doing. I had no idea what AA was, no idea whatsoever. And they told me more about them than I ever wanted to know. And I was getting a little nervous. They talked to me for about 2 hours. I mean, this wasn't a 15-minute hello. I mean, they're sitting there talking to me, and they said, "Well, we can make arrangements for you to change your life. If you will, if you want to." Then they got me talking about, you know, I was unhappy, and I told them a few of the things. You know, I said, "Yeah." And they said, "Are you unhappy with your wife?" I said, "No." I said, "No, I'm not unhappy with her." I said, "I'm unhappy with me." And they said, "Well, we can help you change that." And I'm getting a little interested to see what they're talking about. He said, "I've talked to your father-in-law in New York." My father-in-law and my mother-in-law were in New York on a business trip. And he said, "If you would be willing to go to Hazelden, they would pick up the tab." I had no idea what Hazelden was. Nor did they tell me. You know, I said, "Hazelden." I said, "What is it?" He said, "Oh, it's a treatment center for alcoholism." I says, "Well, I don't think I'm an alcoholic." He said, "Well, what is an alcoholic?" "Well," I says, "I don't know." I said, "But I don't think I'm one." And he said, "Well, would you agree to go?" I said, "Well, listen." I said, "As you can see, I'm in the middle of being thrown out of my apartment. If you can get me back into the house, I would be willing to go and try this." He said, "Well, let me see if I can do that." So he talked to Sue, told me, he said, "I would be more than willing," she said she'd be more than willing to let me come in and stay until I went to treatment. And I was happy with that. Now I'm thinking, "Oh, when do I have to go?" "Well," he says, "we've checked on that." And he says, "The soonest we can get you in is next Friday." "Next Friday?" "Well," I said, "I've got work." He said, "I'll take care of that." And I thought, oh, my God. All week long, I'm thinking, a week? 5 days, actually. 5 days I had to wait. He said, "Are you willing to do it? Will you make that commitment for yourself?" And he said, for yourself. And I remember that. And I said, yeah, I'm willing to do that. Not having any idea of doing that. And I thought, what am I saying to this man? And then he did something that I don't know. I've never done it. I know they used to do it, but he did it, and John did it that day. He said, now we're all going to kneel down. I thought, what is going on here? So we all knelt down, and we said a prayer for my life. Those three guys, the three of us, John, Chuck, and myself. I'm praying to get sober. I was a little amazed that I was on my knees praying to get sober. I was a little amazed that I had committed myself to go to Hazeldon, a place that I had no idea what it was. And I was saying things that I didn't know why I was saying them, except I was just, I think the old expression, sick and tired of being sick and tired, must have been instilled in me somewhere without me even knowing it. And I was very, very unhappy. So I said, I'm willing to do this. And he looked at me, and I'll never forget that little guy. He wasn't a very big man. And he looked at me, he looked me right in the eye, and he said, do you think you can stay sober till Friday? Well, of course I can. Of course. And I'm standing here telling you, swearing to you, that it was the hardest 5 days of sobriety that I have ever had. I wanted to drink almost every minute, probably every second. I wanted to drink so bad because that was my cure-all. I mean, that was what fixed me. That's what deadened my mind. And I didn't know what else worked. But that guy would call me at least 3 times a day, and then I would stop and see him after work at Midway Ford, and then we'd walk across the street to Griggs Cooper and have coffee with Glenn Flanagan, and then he'd talk, bring me somewhere else, and God, we visited more people in that little stop than they were all in the program. So I... But that was the hardest 5 days. And I remember I got home from work that Friday, and my wife had the dinner. She had my table set, and dinner's ready. And we had dinner, and the little girls, you know, there. And I thought, oh, God, you know, how am I going to get out of this? And the phone rings, and it's Charlie. He said, are you about ready to go? I said, well, Charlie, I said, you know, I've been thinking about this. And I said, I don't know if you realize this. And now I'm looking at my wife, and I can see her looking at me, and she's, you know, she's got, well, that SOB is trying to get out of this. And I says, you know, Charlie, you don't realize this. I said, but tomorrow, I said, is an important day in our lives. I said, it's my 3rd wedding anniversary. And I said, I really think, I want to laugh thinking about it. I said, I really think that the place for me to be tomorrow is home here with my wife. And Charlie was quiet for a second, and then he said, why don't you ask her? Well, I look at Sue, and I mean, you know, I think even tears were starting to form in her eyes, you know, and she just couldn't believe what I was trying to do. And I said, I am ready. I said, I'm ready. I'll be ready. And that was my trip up to Hazeldon. It was a long ride, just for the quietness. It was very, very quiet in that car. They didn't even talk to each other. And then he got to about Center City or whatever it was, and then Chuck started telling me, he said, you know, you've got your whole life ahead of you. You know, he said, you're 24 years old. You're not even 25. You're 24 years old. You got your whole life ahead of you. And he said, you